Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hi, my friends. My name is Amy Kaufman, and I'm one of Melbourne's very own local authors. As we begin, I respectfully acknowledge that today my guest and I are speaking from the lands of the Kulin Nation, in particular of the Boonwurrung people and the Wurundjeri people. We pay our respects to their elders and the elders of all communities and cultures across Australia. In today's podcast, I have the great pleasure of speaking to Karen Ginnane about her fantastic debut novel, When Days Tilt. Karen, I was really looking forward to our original Melbourne Writers Festival event, and I am so thrilled that I haven't missed the chance to talk to you and to ask all of the questions that I have been saving up for you. So let's start at the very beginning, before we hit the book itself. You started writing very early in life, didn't you?
I did, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here, Amy, and I'm so glad that this could happen. So thank you for your part in making it possible. Yes, I made up stories and scenarios from the very beginning, before I started writing things down even. I would make up these little daydreams, create characters, have little adventures with them through the day to myself. I had a little dragon that lived in my ear that I would just carry around with me, and he made the day a lot more interesting. So when I look back now, my love of magic and fantasy was there right from the start. This was joined by an intensely horsey phase when I was a teenager, and I became obsessed with drawing horses really badly. And I read all the Silver Brumby books, My Friend Flicker, Black Beauty, a whole equine canon. And that was when I self-published my first book, which was the imaginatively titled A Horse Named Ginger, and, complete with illustrations bound with string. It was a thing of beauty. Fortunately, the world has been spared my illustrations since then, and since then I've written constantly. I've got boxes of books and diaries and scribblings from over the years. I was an obsessive reader, and when I was young, I just put authors up on a pedestal. They were these magical beings that created worlds, and I was completely dumbstruck. In fact, I don't remember meeting an author when I was growing up, but if I had, I would have been completely dumbstruck, just with awe. They were so magnificent that I never contemplated that I could actually be one. And it's made me realize since then how important it is to show kids, to meet kids, authors and artists and other creators, to just show them the different paths to writing, whatever the art form is, and to show them what's possible, because talent is one thing, but determination and self-belief is so much of that as well. And it took me quite a long time to realise that I was a writer. You know, I've always processed my experiences through the written word, but I took a little while to sort of realise that that was what I needed to do and to get serious about the craft.
Oh, I love that. And I mean, I think for my money, a little girl with a dragon in her ear is every bit as magical a beast as an author. I know what you're saying about the need to communicate that to the little girls with dragons.
That's right, and to know that, you know, that is completely wonderful, and you should definitely, you know, not keep that to yourself or be ashamed of it, and show them how to channel that magic.
Yes, and you did, and now here we are. So I want to come to When Days Tilt, and I have a long list of questions, but before we get too deep into them, I know not all of our listeners will have had a chance to pick it up yet. So what's the quick pitch? How do we describe it to the new readers?
Okay. When Days Tilt is an historical fantasy. It's set in London in 1858. It follows 14-year-old Ava, who is a reluctant watchmaking apprentice and also frustrated by the restrictions of her life as a girl at this time in this place. At this time, London is the biggest city the world has ever seen. It's fast, it's furious, it's brutal. And the latest terror is that people are disappearing into thin air. When they return, if they return, they are damaged. Their souls are torn. One day, Ava's life is turned upside down when she discovers that the body in her mother's grave that she's been visiting all her life is that of a stranger. She also encounters a strange, twisted version of London called Dunlin. So Ava has to discover who her mother really is, who she really is, and what they both have to do with the disappearances on the streets of London, and why she has to be the one to stop them.
I love that. That does capture all the things that I loved about it, because we do see Ava go very quickly from, you know, I mean, no spoilers, but at the very, you know, the very opening scene, we see her trying to do what she's supposed to do with the watchmaking and just being utterly frustrated at all the tiny pieces. You know, this is a girl who's meant for adventures.
Yeah, exactly.
I love asking about origin stories. Do you remember sort of what the first spark was for When Days Tilt? You know, sometimes stories show up almost fully formed and sometimes the bits show up over the years. So how was it for you?
Well, it was very much piece by piece. It was one vivid image, a snippet, a concept, one after the other that I pulled together. And I think that's kind of just my writing style. Actually, in fact, it actually started out as rhyming couplets for my kids when I was living in London at the very beginning. But there is one really clear spark, and that is London itself. In fact, London really was the first character because I lived there for around 15 years on and off. And when I first got there, I was so struck by the way that this old, old city just seemed to be enmeshed into the ground it was on. And it was so different for me as an Aussie, coming from an ancient land where relatively new and alien cities have just been plonked on the top and no relationship really between the two. So in London, I could practically feel the stories bubbling up from the streets and that humans had walked for hundreds of years. And at the same time, different parts of London seemed to have distinct characters that seemed innate, no matter how much gentrification went on around them. It was almost as if all the humanity that had lived there had cast a shadow that was residue and immovable. And so from that feeling came the idea of characters who are born of particular places. So Greenwich becomes a green witch who governs time. The Seven Sisters are the matriarchal gang of London, much feared. Oxford Circus, which is in the second book, is an extreme circus event that makes or breaks people. And Threadneedle Street gave birth to some of my favourite characters ever, who is the seamstress and her Needleys, and they come in book two. Yeah, that was the very first spark. And after that, other ideas developed around time, how you spend your time on this earth, you know, that sort of thing. And as my characters developed, I found my plot, which tied all these little strands together into the whole that you now see in the book.
Karen, I love that. I love the layers on layers. I mean, from the moment you, and I have questions later on about your research and how you created those sensory details. I just love London as a character, but then London literally as characters as well. To stay with the origin story for a moment longer, I love to ask authors about the moment that their book sold, especially their first book, because, you know, this is the culmination of everything. So do you remember where take me there? Where were you?
What God, happened? I remember it so clearly. Yes, I remember it. Yeah, obviously I've been, you know, quite a late in life debut author, so this is just such an exciting moment to sort of reach this finally. I got an email from my agent, who's Danielle Binks, with a publishing offer from Penguin on May the 16th, 2019. And if I wouldn't remember that anyway, it's also my wedding anniversary, which we often do forget. No longer. Usually one of us forgets, but not anymore. So it had been a very long courtship with Penguin that had started back with a literary speed date back in 2017, actually. And when I just pitched the concept of a historical version of the book I was working on, and they expressed interest, I submitted it, and actually I had very positive, you know, they loved it actually, and they said they wanted to take it further, and they were saying very nice things about it in the end of 2018. So my hopes were high from that time, but it all took so much longer than expected, and I really thought it wasn't going to go ahead at all, and Danielle and I were going out on wider pitch when this came through. So, yeah, I couldn't believe it. I really thought it wasn't going to happen by the time it did happen. And also my dad was in Melbourne from WA at that time, so he was there. He's been my biggest fan. He's read every single version of everything I've ever written, all thinks it's all wonderful. So it was really lovely that he was there. And, you know, I rushed out and bought a bottle of champagne and we all danced around the kitchen.
Amazing, as we should make a habit of.
Exactly.
Correct. But, I mean, the book's dedicated to your parents, so what an amazing thing to have one of them there.
It was really wonderful, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, was it always going to be historical for you? What drew you back to old London as opposed to, you know, the London you lived in?
Well, I am a history nerd. I love it. I studied it at uni along with literature. And I've always been fascinated by the stories that lead up to where we are now. And, you know, history has this, can have an image problem. It can be seen as dry and dusty and just a bunch of old dates that you have to memorize. But the thing is about history is that until the moment it becomes history, it's just life. You know, it's just messy, human, unpredictable life. And the thing is, everything that happens is because of people and their feelings, their hopes, their dreams, their fears. And it's a bit like any good book, really. And so history on the page is just one part of their story. There's so much that's omitted or just wrong. And history is very far from done and dusted. And I think, you know, the history we receive is a starting point and looking at it from other points of view. Yeah. So I love history. I've always been interested in it. But having said that, it wasn't historical. And in fact, I came to that decision relatively late in the work. And that was when I got a nice rejection for the contemporary book that it was at the time, saying that perhaps I could look at actually suggesting that a historical concept or something around the setting, which is obviously integral to the plot, could sort of make that, sort of a bit more alive, a bit more vivid. And that was a real aha moment for me because I was just like, yes, actually, yes, this is where that book belongs. And I came very quickly to Victorian London as being the setting, and that was obviously the home for my book. And once I made that decision, it was just, that's it. And, it's the biggest city the world had ever seen. It was this incredible time of development. Technology so extraordinary, it seemed like magic, like the telegraph, beginnings of social commentary, flowering literature and science, time, obviously, and extremes of poverty and wealth, brutality and wonder, and it just seemed to have the energy I needed. And part of me was worried that it'd been done to death. I thought, what else can you say about Victorian London, surely the most documented period in British history? But then what struck me is what it would have felt like to live through it at the time, not looking back through a Dickensian prism, sort of that nostalgic sort of way we tend to look back at Victorian London, but how it would have felt to live it with all this change and all this technology and this uncertainty. And, the occult was right up there next to science and they rubbed shoulders. And I think it would have been like a dystopian sort of futuristic thing is to us now, like Blade Runner. And that sense of energy is what made me feel like, that's where I want to put my book. And that's what I want to evoke, actually.
Well, that sense of energy is exactly what I want to ask you about. Although I have to pause for a moment to say it is almost impossible to believe this book was ever set any other time because it is so effortlessly a story of Victorian London. But one of the things that struck me most about When Days Tilt was that it is so incredibly immersive. I was so impressed even after the first few pages because it genuinely feels like you've stepped through a door and into another time, but as I was reading, maybe 95% of me was the reader just going somewhere else and 5% of me was the author thinking, oh my goodness, because I know every sensory detail, every smell on the street, every item of clothing they put on, every place they go, every meal they eat, if they decide to walk down a certain street, every bit of that adds to your mountain of research. So
absolutely.
Can you tell us for a moment, how did you go about that?
Well, firstly, thank you. That means a lot to hear that it has that effect on you. I was like a bowerbird. I collected anything I could find to do with that period. And there is a lot to do with that period. Luckily for me, Victorian London is incredibly well documented, thanks to the literature of the time. You have Dickens, it was a real flowering of literature at the time. It was, the reign of Queen Victoria. It was, you had Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1850. So much was going on around that time, whether it's science, technology, literature. It was also an population explosion, so social commentary started to happen at this time for the first time in history. So, I just read and reread the literature of that period, but also books about that period. There's so many excellent resources. One of my favourites is a book called How to Be a Victorian by Ruth Goodman, and she lived as a Victorian woman on a farm for a year. It did everything as they did.
A year?
For a whole year, and she immersed herself in that, and this book takes you through the day. So what it's like from when you get up, what you do, what's the first thing you put your foot down on the floor, what you dress in, how you do the laundry, which was the most hideous chore imaginable. you know, what you eat, what you wear, all of that stuff. And she takes you through, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's so exuberantly written. It's a great read. Also, Victorian London by Liza Pickard, the books by Henry Mayhew, which were the first, one of the very first forms of social reportage. He was one of the first to look at the lives of ordinary people and poor people and go into those in detail, and the poverty obviously was truly shocking, like nothing we can imagine now. I read an amazing book called, which is slightly off on a tangent, called Necropolis by Catherine Arnold, which was about the frequently disgusting history of London cemeteries and just the way they...
Yeah, I mean, it becomes quite relevant.
It is relevant. And also, the you know, the Victorians invented death, right? You know, that all those rituals around funerals and mourning, that comes from Victorian London. So they were obsessed. And there was a lot of death. There was a lot of death. You know, there's a lot of people and there's a lot of cholera outbreaks. So it was a big issue.
Yeah, well, they had this very interesting kind of duality that they managed to hold the Victorians, yes, between, if it's one of our people who's dead, we need to do all the rituals and put them in a cemetery.
Right.
But if it's someone from somewhere else who's dead, we'll just take them and put them in a museum.
Exactly, you know, right. That's a great insight.
The dualities they managed to hold were quite something.
The Victorians held many dualities in many different ways. I think they had a real talent at it. I was going to say, there was another great book on the Victorian Telegraph, which was like the Victorian internet. It had the same impact on their life as the internet does on ours today.
Wow.
So things, and you know, there was, do you want me to go on? There was so much. I read histories of Greenwich, the Observatory of the Great Stink. I talked to people, you know, there was really helpful people at the Worshipful Society of Clockmakers in London.
What was your favourite tidbit you learned? Is there one thing that blew your mind?
Oh, well, I really loved the fact that Queen Victoria was a party girl. I love, you know, we've got this image of her as this grumpy, dumpy little dowager. And actually, she loved music. She loved dancing. She would dance all night, wear out her shoes. She was obsessed with lion tamers. She sang opera. She was quite the raunchy lady. She loved her husband Albert's fine physique, and she was passionate and affectionate, and she would fly into these rages that Albert called her combustibles. So I love that, because I hadn't realised that. That was from Julia Baird's fantastic biography of Victoria.
That is fantastic. Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. Her, she does have an image problem.
She does.
Compared to that version.
She really
so
does.
Speaking of women who impress us, I guess, let's talk a bit about Ava,
okay,
the heroine of the story. We meet her as the reluctant clockmaker, and she very quickly becomes a lot of other things. I say a little deliberately mysteriously, because I want to tempt our listeners to read the book for themselves. But how did Ava evolve as you wrote her?
Well, it's interesting actually, because the book went through many permutations, but Ava is the one character who didn't change very much. And so she was, of all the characters, she's the one who changed the least in the writing. So she was always that same girl. Even when she was in contemporary London, she was still feisty, unconventional, easily frustrated. But when she went into Victorian London as a watchmaking apprentice and I could give her piles of sewing to do, that frustration became much more real, you know, as well as the limitations on her life as a young girl. So, yeah, she has always just been who she is, and I never really had to think about her too much. She was kind of arrived on the page and just did what she did. And, you know, I love her dearly in a somewhat exasperated sort of way, but
they become very real, don't they?
They do. Yes, they do. Yeah.
I want to ask a little about your writing life.
Yeah.
You know, do you write in great big possessed tears that go for days, or is it a little bit each morning, or, you know, how do you build your books?
I wrote around my children for years, so I became really good at writing in the creases of the day. So it's amazing how much you can get down in 10 minutes, and I became very good at that discipline. I can't write with musical words in my head, but I'm absolutely fine with white noise. So, you know, I actually really love writing in cafes, on public transport, you know, when my kids were younger, when I was waiting for them to come out of the pool at swimming lessons. But having said that, my absolute favourite time to write is first thing in the morning. So I wake up, throw on my dressing gown, grab a cup of tea, and then sit down. I don't look at the internet. I don't look at my emails. I don't read the news, nothing. And I try and stay in that just woken phase for as long as possible. And that's my clear time. That's when things rise up. That's when I can sort of just go into that world very clearly. And then I love to, yeah, I do love to write in great tears. I do love to sort of, I do these DIY writing retreats where I just take myself off with a box of food and my books, and that's it. And I just immerse myself, and I love that. That's my favourite type part of the writing process, actually, when you're just getting it all down on the page and it's just immersive.
Yes, very much mine too. And so I know for the sequel, When Souls Tear, which is coming out in 2022, you got to go to Varuna to work on it, which is, I imagine, one of the more immersive things you can do. Could you tell us a bit about what that was like?
In a word, bliss. You know, it was everything you can imagine. It was just a room of one's own, looking out over the beautiful gardens there, enforced silence during the day, which suited my nerdy little heart very well. So everybody had to work. There was no chat. There was nothing. So you just worked, you know, obviously to your own rhythms. And then dinner was cooked for you every night by the glorious Sheila, who is the most glamorous octogenarian cook you will ever encounter. She used to serve dinner with these amazing dangly earrings and her hair swept up in a chignon. And we'd sit around and we'd talk. And then at the end of the day, you're with these really intelligent, funny, engaged people, and you're talking about writing and books and writing life. And yeah, it was just glorious. I had a really fantastic group. I was very, very lucky. And in fact, we're still in touch. We met up just a couple of weeks ago in Melbourne and had a catch up. So yeah, it was everything I imagined and more. I loved it.
It does. It sounds very much like what we all imagine writing life to be.
It really was.
And writing life is not always.
That's right. And I had built it up in my head, and I was fully expecting to be disappointed because, you know, the expectations were high, but they met them, definitely.
Oh, I love that. So, I have so many questions left, and I want to make sure I fit them in. So I wanted to ask a little bit about your life experiences, because you have had a list of very cool jobs. And, you know, as you say, you've lived in London, and that's not the only place you've traveled. You know, when we consciously research when we go to history books and when we pull out these big stacks to read about what life was like in another time, but we're researching the rest of the time as well. You know, I think the fears people have that we're going to put them in our novels are kind of valid a lot of the time. They just don't show up in the ways they expect. But I was wondering, are there moments from your own life or your own experiences that you've woven into the book?
You know, that's very true. And yes, I have done a lot of things, but a lot of it was never planned. I tend to sort of be quite instinctive about and reactive about what I do and where I go. So I guess the thing that's in common with across all the different things I've done over my life is the fact that I've often felt like an outsider. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, I was a very shy kid, actually. So there was a bit element of when I was younger of social, feeling outside the social sphere. But not just that. It's as when you travel or when you go to a new place or a new job or just a new experience of any kind, really, it's that feeling of sort of looking in and being hyper aware of your environment and the people in it, sort of gauging the shifts in mood or the attention, the subtext of body language, what people wear, the way they approach things. Yeah, I've always been very, very aware of that, and I've always been quick to respond to it. So it's, partly social survival strategy, but also a genuine interest, a fascination in seeing how the world ticks, seeing how people tick. And that's why I've traveled so widely, because I'm just so fascinated by the differences, but also the similarities are the most profound things. But there's all these other fascinating differences in the way people structure their lives. So I'm always imagining myself into the lives of others. And maybe all writers do this, because it's a short step from that to actually imagining the characters on the page. And all feeds in all the time. You're absolutely right. I can't point to anything in particular, but that person I saw on the streets of Paris will end up in a story, you know, 5 years later over here. And that's the way it works for me. It's like a big pile of compost.
It is. I mean, you know, that's a Tolkien quote. Professor Tolkien talked about the creative compost we create from all of the things that we take in.
Exactly right.
You know, every time you're so right. When you travel, when you observe people, when you figure out why they are the way they are, you're more able, I think, to consciously draw them to mind then when you want to create your own characters.
Exactly.
So one place you have never felt like an outsider, I suspect, is with your parents. You know, you talked about your dad and you dedicated the book to them. It was a truly beautiful dedication. And again, I'm going to be deliberately a little vague. The familial relationships in your book are not as uncomplicated as that. How did you go about building them all?
Well, to be honest, it was a bit of a journey discovery for me as well. It was very, I suppose I was a bit inspired by Dickens, just the way, you know, everything is, you find out all these connections in everything, all these, just so many parts, moving parts, which all end up sort of having some sort of connection. But it was for me, like, it wasn't something cleverly structured. I would like to claim that it was, but it was very much like, you know, when you're doing your family tree and you're digging away here and you find that little bit there and then you find, oh, there's this person over here, and then you realise that they were actually married to that person down there and there's that child that was a result and that sort of thing. It honestly, like even just the last book, I was just finishing the edits of book two and I discovered something about the interrelationships across the two stories that I hadn't been aware of. And it just, all these other things fell into place as a result. So for me, it's been a quite fascinating discovery myself of how it all comes together and you know, reveals bit by bit by bit.
Oh, I love that. I remember reading Douglas Adams, I think it was in one of the forewords to one of the various editions I own of The Hitchhiker's Guide, and he said something like, when some twist or turn seemed to throw light upon that which had gone before, nobody was so pleasantly surprised as I.
He's just put it much better than I just did, but that's exactly what, that's exactly right.
It is very nice, though, when it looks like you were clever all along. And I think it is a sort of cleverness to be able to spot that thing and weave it into what has gone before.
Hmm.
It's just a different cleverness to having planned it from the start.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a lesser kind at all.
No, it is a different one. It's a subconscious cleverness. I'm a big fan of my subconscious. I've put a lot of faith into it.
Yes, no, me too. I wanted to, you mentioned the Silver Brumby earlier, which I was also a huge fan of. Essentially, my local library didn't own a copy of The Silver Brumby because I just borrowed it on repeat throughout my childhood. The happiest day of my life
loved it.
Was when their happiest day was when their bound copy eventually fell apart from all of my borrowing and I was able to buy it at a secondhand sale. And what I felt should always have mine became mine. But what else? What are the reading memories do you have growing up? What did you love?
Oh, I read everything I could get my hands on. My mum is English and she made sure we had all the Enid Blyton books, you know, they're so many of them. So I love The Wishing Chair and The Magic Faraway Tree. Absolutely read those to pieces. I loved Alice in Wonderland, Wind in the Willows. I devoured the Tales of Narnia, especially The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe, and also The Hobbit. I loved Trixie Belden. Do you remember Trixie Belden? And
Pippi, Trixie Belden Mysteries.
Yeah, and Pippi Longstocking. I also loved nature and animals. So, obviously The Silver Brumby, but also Watership Down. Oh, my God, the first book I remember crying over, I think. And also Storm Boy. And there was a book called My Side of the Mountain, which was an American writer set in the Catskills of New York State, where a boy sort of survives in the wild, and I wanted to be him, and all those books. But my absolute favourites were those ones that had that little shimmer of wonder about them, you know, like The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, like Alan Garner, the obviously The Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula Le Guin, who's probably, if I had to choose one, probably one of my all-time favourites. And also there was this book called The Stream That Stood Still by Beverly Nichols, which is a little book about some children who have adventures with the fish underwater, which I love, which is quite magical as well. So, yes, it was. I read everything I could get my hands on, basically, but those are the ones that stand out in my memory.
And now you've written a book with a shimmer of wonder. There are going to be readers out there who are going to read it over and over and over again and come back to it like you came back to those books.
Very humbling thought, actually.
It is. Well, for our final question, I wanted to wrap up with, just to come back to your books once more, do you have a moment in When Days Tilt that's, you know, whether it's a phrase you loved or just something that really resonated with you on a personal level, or just, you know, something that you really nailed it? Do you have a favourite moment you can share?
Yeah, I suppose what I'm most proud of and most surprised by, it's not one particular moment, but it's the way that, like, this quirky and slightly camp set of rhyming couplets about London developed into something much deeper with all these big themes, like what it is to be human, having agency in a life that seems to have none, self-discovery and truth-finding, the value of time, all of this without me consciously doing it. And I guess it was back to what we were just saying about the subconscious. That has been the biggest discovery for me. It's like the power of the subconscious is truly humbling. I thought I was writing this rollicking historical fantasy adventure about time, and I was, and I was loving that. But there are sections that still make me prickle when I read them. Yeah, I was continually surprised by what ended up on the page. And, you know, I still cry when I read certain scenes, which seems crazy to me, like Jack and the lady at the end, the final scene between Aya and her mother, most things with Malaika in them. I love Malaika. And Jack, there's something about Jack that absolutely wrenches at my heart. And it's this kind of richness. It just keeps taking me by surprise as if I had nothing to do with it. And I guess,
yeah,
I
love that feeling.
I guess that's the magic of writing, isn't it?
Having co-authored a lot of books, I think I used to spot those parts and assume my co-author had written them. But then when I've worked on solo books, I find a bit that I have no memory of that I love and think, well, I suppose I put that there.
And it's that truly magical, I find that the magical part of writing. I suppose that's the part that I'm most proud of.
Yeah. An author friend asked me just the other day if she was being self-indulgent, if she cried when she read her own work. And I said my attitude was, if not you, then who? Then, you know, your heart's on the page.
That's right. I think if you're not crying or laughing, then how can your audience?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, Karen Ganane and your amazing subconscious. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. As we wrap, I want to remind listeners that they can buy When Days Tilt, but from the Melbourne Writers Festival partner bookshop, Readings, and they should, if I might suggest a copy for a friend. No, thank you. And as we close, Karen and I, we both want to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in and for supporting the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thank you, Amy, and Melbourne Writers Festival for making this possible. It's been a joy and a privilege.
Well, everyone, we can't wait to see you again in person in the future. But for now, happy reading.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.